Welcome to Conversations With, a podcast series exploring the people and practices shaping the impact of private philanthropy to benefit communities across Africa. Conversations With is produced by the Africa Grantmakers Affinity Group, working to promote robust, effective, and responsive philanthropy and to build a network of informed, engaged, and connected funders. Visit the AfricaGrantmakers.org website for program notes and to join our mailing list.
Welcome. Thank you for joining the Africa Grantmakers Affinity Group for this segment of Conversations With. I'm Niamani Mutima, and today's topic is community philanthropy in Zimbabwe. So I'm pleased to welcome our guests from the Civio Institute based in Harare, Zimbabwe, Etta Joa and Dr. Tendai Marisa. Welcome, Etta and Tendai.
Thank you so much, Niamani.
Thank you.
So thank you both for taking the time to join us to talk about two of your recent reports, Community Foundations in Zimbabwe, Analysis of 11 Case Studies, and Evaluating Impact of COVID-19 on Community-Based Organizations and Foundations. So taken together, both of these reports help us to understand the landscape of community philanthropy in Zimbabwe, and how these organizations are serving their different communities, and how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected them and the work that they're doing. So before we talk about your research, Tendai, can you give us an overview of the Civio Institute and how this type of research fits within the overall mission of the organization?
Oh, yes. Thank you so much, Niamani. For colleagues who may know me from my previous life, I was once with Trust Africa. So when I left Trust Africa in 2017, took a bit of time to find out what we actually want to do. So we did a bit of scanning and we realized that there was an opportunity in Zimbabwe for a think tank or a think and do organization that will focus, well, something that we've always been interested in to do with how do we create an inclusive society. But also the background is in 2015, we published a book called Beyond the Crisis, Zimbabwe's Prospects for Inclusive Transformation. So in that book, we had raised a number of questions around what it would take for Zimbabwe to sort of achieve inclusive transformation. We spent a bit of time going through what needs to be done in terms of setting up. We had just had three focus areas to say, how, number one, how do we achieve inclusive growth? Number two, how do we ensure that citizens are at the center of the development that they want to see in their country? Number three, how do we make sure that the government is effective in delivering on its promises? Those were the questions we're asking, because we believe that if those were addressed adequately, they could contribute to a different kind of an inclusive society. So our work is literally focused on those, even the way we're organized. We have a center for policy analysis and advocacy, which literally focuses on tracking what government is doing, providing policy advice, support, preparation of policy briefs, policy think notes. And also we keep an online tracker of the conversion of government's promises from during the elections. Like, you guys have just gone through elections, you know what your winning candidate has sort of promised. So we put that into a sort of an online platform, checking on how the government is doing. So that is accessible to anyone, anywhere in the world. Then the second center is our center on philanthropy, because we believe that the transformation that has to occur has to be driven by Zimbabweans. The challenges that we had was this government was framing transformation around issues of attracting foreign direct investment, attracting international aid, etc. But we began to say we need to see how communities are mobilizing resources on their own. So we began this center for philanthropy, which sort of, yes, we know of the high net worth individual giving. We know of everything that has been spoken about official foundations, but we know very little about how communities are actually organized and how they exercise solidarity and in the process giving to each other. If you like, this is from the poor to the poor or from many to many. That kind of philanthropy is rarely talked about in Zimbabwe. Then the third part was to say, we also need to see that we grow entrepreneurship as a culture. but our focus is on entrepreneurs with a social impact. So in a nutshell, that's how our work is organized. Legally, we are registered as a country program in Zimbabwe, but we are also registered as a 501c3 charity in the US, because our work since the beginning of this year has begun to expand back into the continent. We've just set up a program now that looks at what citizens do to each other in the four sub-regions of Africa. So in a nutshell, that's what CVO is all about. Like I said, we're a think and do organization. We're interested in thinking through what are the problems, but we're also interested in coming up with sort of solutions to some of these things. And we begin to get our hands dirty. Edda will explain some of the things we have done during the COVID-19 era in terms of not just studying organizations that were responding to COVID, but helping them to kickstart some of the activities that we thought were necessary in terms of responses to COVID-19. Thanks, Niamani.
So, Edda, do you want to talk a little bit about your work in the Center for Philanthropy and Communities?
Yes, thanks, Niamani. I think as Tanay has highlighted, our work in the center is really focused on nurturing giving across Zimbabwe by Zimbabweans. And what we've seen is that when the idea of giving or philanthropy is talked about within Zimbabwe, the primary focus and, you know, a growing body of work has been mostly around high net worth individuals and setting up foundations and giving. So you've got foundations like Higher Life Foundation. I think that's been one of the most prominent ones, which is led by Strive and Sitsi Masiwa. But for us, in terms of what our focus is and this strive and drive for an inclusive society, and also understanding that communities, grassroots communities, have historically had solidarity and been involved in, you know, solidarity activities. Our role and our work is really focused on trying to unearth, you know, more of the peer-to-peer giving that's happening within communities, you know, and how we can understand and map what is happening, you know, which is, and a byproduct of that is this report that we've done on community foundations in Zimbabwe. We initially also started off just trying to understand just the perception of giving within Zimbabwe, just from ordinary citizens. Do they give? Who are they giving to? And why do they give? And for us, that's really focusing, again, as I said, on just understanding and mapping what is happening within this space in Zimbabwe. And as we do that, we are also then thinking about how we then can enhance these practices of giving and give them more prominence in terms of what is being done and, you know, how communities are doing it. Using that information, we are also developing interventions to strengthen the entire giving or philanthropy value chain in Zimbabwe. So we've developed what we're calling the Philanthropy Lab, which right now it's an online platform, but we hope to then also migrate it to become also something physical that looks at six key areas that we believe as CVO are quite important to then enhance and grow community philanthropies. So aspects around legal components, registration, processes such as setting up boards, the necessary administrative structures to ensure accountability and, you know, proper planning of activities and structures, operations, having the right team in place to mobilize resources within communities, but then also develop the necessary programs and activities to make an impact. Visibility, the community philanthropy that's happening on the ground, being told, and organizations being able to tell their story of what is that they're doing. And through doing so, being then able to mobilize more resources, which they will complement with the community resources as well to then advance development. Collaboration. So for us, that's something that's quite key. We want to be able to also provide a means and a ways for different entities, different community foundations to then come together and be able to collaborate and enhance the work that they're doing, the impact that they're having, and also use that collaboration to just enhance the policy space around philanthropy and giving in Zimbabwe. And then lastly, it's around IT support. One of the things that we pride ourselves as CVO is being an organization that likes to leverage off of technology. And we also feel that this is important and linked quite closely to the aspect of visibility, but also process and operations to create platforms for organizations to be able to receive donations. Even if it's a Zimbabwean-based organization, we have a plethora of Zimbabweans in the diaspora, if they wanted to give, what platforms could be set up for them to continue giving, even internally, things like having websites and having processes to all platforms or systems to help account for the funds that are received and to acknowledge and just be accountable for all of this. So for us, it's important because we're raising the work that we're doing in our center of philanthropy is raising the importance of domestic resource mobilization. The worsening economic crisis in Zimbabwe has been borne mostly by, the brunt of it has been mostly borne by citizens, yet there's not been a total collapse. And we feel because of what communities are doing in and amongst themselves that there's not been this total collapse. And for us, the severe role is to then enhance and show what giving is taking place on the ground at grassroots level and enhancing that further.
That's great, Etta. So now let's talk a little bit about your research into community philanthropy and the organizations you profiled in your report. So as you pointed out, the Community Foundation of Western Region of Zimbabwe and the Ubuntu Community Foundation are probably the most well-known community foundations. So why are they more well-known and are they different from the other foundations profiled in your report?
So the two organizations that you mentioned, I think one thing is that they've had a long history of existence. So the Community Foundation for the Western Region in Zimbabwe was established in 1998 and then Ubuntu Community Foundation in 2008. So for Community Foundation for the Western Region in Zimbabwe, that's just over 22 years of existence. For the Ubuntu Community Foundation, that's 12 years. So the difference, ironically, both of these entities, you know, are operating in the southern and western parts of Zimbabwe and have their offices in Bulawayo. But like we felt that because of the long history that they've had and they've been in existence, they've been able to establish strong organizational structures and become resourced enough to engage with the growing debates around community philanthropy regionally and also globally. The aspect of community philanthropy, community giving, is still quite a fairly new phenomenon in terms of research, work, publication around it in Zimbabwe. So very little research has been done on community foundations in Zimbabwe, and it's still an underdeveloped area. And I think because of that, for these two entities and the work that they've been doing, there's been limited platforms for them for engagement and developing a network of other community foundations in Zimbabwe. And we felt for them, it's therefore been easier for them to connect more with community foundations outside of Zimbabwe and gain more prominence outside of the country with regards to the work that they are doing. I think one of the standout things for the community, especially for the Community Foundation for the Western Region in Zimbabwe, is that they've managed to build up the Community Endowment Fund, you know, which is a perpetual financial source for their local development needs. Whilst this is one of, you know, it's a key factor for us in terms of having identified the entities that we profiled as community foundations. For a lot of them, whilst they draw upon community resources or, you know, members within the community pay subscriptions or provide resources for operations or skills and time just around programming, they've not yet been able to set up, you know, that something as well-structured and as formalized as the Community Endowment Fund that the Community Foundation for the Western Region of Zimbabwe has, and then use that as the main catalyst for supporting local development needs and leveraging off of external resources. So there are some similarities, but I think for us, that was like the one key thing in terms of like how long they've been in existence, but what it's also enabled these two organizations to kind of do in the time that they, you know, and set up solid structures vis-a-vis some entities that we profiled who were established in 2016, 2015. So they're still young, they're still growing, but at the same time, they've not been given also that platform or had the work that they're doing showcased like what we've tried to do through this magazine and through our other publications.
So now your report also examines the different ways communities mobilize resources to support their work. And as you mentioned, such as memberships. So can you talk about the strategies these organizations use to tap into local resources and the relationships they have with other civil society organizations or the business sector and government? Tendai, could you speak to this?
Thanks, Nyamani. So I think one of the things that we did when we got into this work was to sort of broaden the term of what a community foundation is. We use characteristics to say, what does it look like? So the first characteristic is being that a certain component of this organization's resources should be locally sourced. So all the organizations that we have profiled mobilize local resources. For some of them, it's 100% of the budget. For others, it's a portion, which for us is still okay because we understand that there's always a hybrid method to sort of raising resources. Then we went further to begin to say, if they're raising it from communities, how are they doing this? So it's mostly, you know, you join as a member, you become a member, et cetera, et cetera. But also there are other ways. If you look at the ones sort of in Gwanda, this is also in the southern part of Zimbabwe, where they're actually establishing business enterprises that then sort of contribute to the well-being of the organization. And also some of them receive money because they're established through a statute of the law or government. In the 1990s, early 2000s, government came up with an indigenization bill. And in that indigenization bill, they also came up with the idea of what they called community share ownership trusts. So these were established by edict. The government said, we need locals to benefit from mining revenues. So all the companies yet to contribute towards community share ownership trusts established by communities within where they were mining. So you find in the magazine, you see that these are the ones which have big budgets. And mostly those ones are the ones that are outliers in terms of the fact that they do not particularly raise resources from within the communities, but they make sure that, number one, the agenda of how those resources are going to be utilized is sort of driven by the communities. So you get a lot of active involvement of the traditional authority structures, the chiefs, etc., and also some community development practitioners. So they come up with their own strategies. Then every year they're supposed to get sort of a certain part of the profit from the mining company and to use that for sort of community development needs that have been identified by the communities. And so that's one sort of relationship that is there. Then there are others that, like the Mutasa Youth Group, you find that it is enough. It is set up in the eastern part of Zimbabwe, it also then has relationships with organizations in Harare, like the Coalition for Debt and Development, the Youth Empowerment Trust, and many other organizations. And through those collaborations, these organizations begin then to be able to mobilize resources either on their own or in joint fundraising platforms with these bigger and more established national NGOs. So it's quite a broad range of strategies that these community foundations then deploy in terms of just sort of their sustainability. And finally, there's a new way that we have seen, it's still latent. It's something that we just picked up in 102, where they are beginning to establish collaboration of relationships with Zimbabweans in the diaspora. So Zimbabweans in the diaspora, for instance, in Australia, have begun to set up associations. Some of those associations have to do with the districts or the villages where they come from. So when they find that there is a community foundation already active in Zimbabwe, they find a conduit for the resources to move from the diaspora so for community engagement. This is something that is exciting because we're seeing sort of the maturing of the Zimbabwean diaspora, especially in diaspora markets like the US, the European Union zone, the UK and Australia, and also South Africa. So the fact that we're beginning to see diaspora remittances moving from supporting just family, but beginning to look at issues to do with the community, we see also a role, especially with the philanthropy lab that Edda made reference to, for us to begin to sort of try to catalyze that kind of giving from Zimbabweans to Zimbabweans, but also just to create a link for Zimbabweans that sort of are nostalgic about the idea of being home, contributing to Zimbabwe's development. We saw this a lot during the COVID-19 period when it had peaked around May and June. So in a nutshell, we're seeing a lot of sort of strategies being deployed towards this. We hope to see how that can sort of, we can build upon that.
You raised this, Tendai, about the impact of COVID-19. So how has COVID affected these organizations and their capacity to help their communities? Etta, do you want to respond to this question?
Sure. Thanks, Niaman. So for us in Zimbabwe, the lockdown measures started from the 30th of March and 2020, and some aspects of it are still currently in place up to now. But for these organizations that one, we profiled in the magazine, but we also did a second study on just in terms of the impact of COVID. For most of them, they adopted mostly a hybrid kind of model of either completely closing their office, but having staff working remotely. So in our study that just really looked at the impact of COVID on organization or community-based organizations, community foundations, you know, 41% of them closed their offices and but had staff working remotely. Whilst about 47% said that their offices were open, but only essential staff were coming in. In this particular study, only one office completely, or one entity indicated that they'd completely shut down and had closed their offices and had stopped operations. Like in varying degrees, most organizations were able to carry on, you know, after the initial shock of, okay, everything is shut down and until there was just more clarity in terms of COVID and how it was going to be managed. There was just like a huge transition for most of these entities, as with other sectors. But for us, what we noted, especially in the organizations that we surveyed, is that for them, a large proportion of these organizations work in rural areas. And so they're extremely dependent on face-to-face interactions and engagements with the communities that they work with. So COVID has meant a major shift in just how they work and a reliance on technology, but primarily things like WhatsApp, just in terms of technology accessibility for communities, for individuals in Zimbabwe. That's the thing that people are mostly closest to or can easily access, given that you can have it on your phone. And WhatsApp was like a huge tool that was used by a lot of these entities to still kind of try and engage and interact with communities. But in terms of trying to do community outreach and engagement, all the organizations that we surveyed in our study on the impact of COVID-19 indicated that they've had to postpone activities because at the same time, there's also been restrictions on travel and public gatherings that were initially banned. And because of that, you know, close to 50% indicated that they'd obviously missed project deadlines that were set in grant agreements or just in terms of their strategy of how what they wanted and what they planned for 2020. Another thing that really affected their operations was just the 47% of the organizations said that they couldn't access their financial resources. So in the initial phases of lockdown, like everything was shut down and you know, there was limits on banking services that were available to people, you know, as other sectors, the finance sector also tried to kind of also come to grips of like, okay, fine, how could they operate in a manner that was sustainable? And things like internet banking for a lot of these entities, it's still quite limited. And people depend a lot on just doing face-to-face interactions in a banking hall. Because of that, I think, and reduce funding, because some entities indicated as well that they had to stop taking in member subscriptions. What we saw was that, you know, a large portion of the organizations indicated that they were not able to pay out or continue to pay out staff salaries for a period in time during this period. So only 35% of the organizations that we surveyed indicated that they were still able to pay their staff salaries. I think it's been a lonely time for a number of these entities in terms of having additional support or backup come in place. 47% of the organizations that we profiled in our COVID-19 study indicated that they'd not received any additional support during lockdown. And I think, you know, for a lot of these entities, one, they're already working with such limited budgets, and most of the costs or most of the resources that are in their budgets are going into programming. So what COVID-19 has exposed was just the significant need of more investment in operational resources as well. And, you know, to help them, I think going forward, there's definitely going to be shifts in the way that people work. But because, again, as I said, there's for the large proportion of them, they're working with rural communities or rural-based communities. There also then just still needs to be that fine balance to ensure that they're not also isolating or leaving behind others within the community that might not have access to technology or the required tools to still engage with them. So I think for us, and you know, just for the entities that we looked at, that there's definitely going to be that shift in terms of how they work, and also just for more resources and funding, you know, to be put into operational costs. Only 35% of the organizations that we interviewed said that they, you know, they were able to give their staff the requisite tools like a laptop or a tablet for them to continue working from home, you know, and working remotely. And only 35% indicated that they were covering the data costs. So I think there's the work would still continue, but it wasn't as extensive. And as there is that need to also adapt and make use of technology, it's just also going to become important to ensure that the communities that are part of the community foundations and benefiting also from the work that community foundations are doing are not left behind in this process to readjust and shift how organizations are going to have to work in the future.
Thank you, Etta. I think for many of us, probably for all of us, you talked about this being a lonely time. It is a lonely time, I think, and all of us are trying to figure out how do we navigate our work, our communities, our support of our families, those types of things. Is there something that surprised you as you did this work on community philanthropy? I mean, you've looked at different organizations and how they work. Was there something that stood out from you when you did your research that surprised you?
I think for us, number one, it's the terms we use in the office and the terms that communities use are different. So if you went out into the communities and looked for philanthropy organizations, you may not find them. You may come back and say there are no philanthropy organizations in Zimbabwe. Or if you went again and looked for what you called community foundations, again, you will not find those in Zimbabwe. Number one, the term foundation is just not common in Zimbabwe. The legal way of registering here, you're either going to register through what we call the Private Voluntary Organizations Act, which is the PVO Act, or you're going to register as a trust. So many entities end up being registered either as trusts or even just as associations. So the first thing we learned, even when we're doing the literature research before going into the field, was to begin to say, we need to understand the language being used by practitioners. So for us, many of these come in the form of either they are called community-based organizations, they are called rural associations, they are called youth forums, etc. So they have many names that they give themselves. So they will not call themselves community foundations, but they are doing the work that we associate with community foundations. I think that's very important. Then number two, we were also surprised that even though they look like they're remote, et cetera, there's a certain level of sophistication in how they've managed to keep going amidst some of the most difficult times. For those of you who've been following the events in Zimbabwe, this is a country that has, in the past 3 years, has had to go through a cholera outbreak. Then we had flooding last year, Cyclone Idai. Then this year, we've joined the rest of the world, COVID-19 pandemic. Besides that, the economy has been underperforming, has been shrinking instead of growing. It's sort of doing things when everything else is going south. But for us, it's the title that we had initially wanted to give to these reports was The Best of Us in the Worst of Times. Because the resilience, community resilience, I don't want to romanticize this thing, but the resilience is amazing that in the midst of the crisis, there is a logic that is emerging around solidarity. And also in another paper that we did for a journal, we picked that up is to say one of the first things that communities do when they come together is to set up an entity that helps to create these synergies, that helps to create sort of a sense of belonging, a sense of identity and collaboration. So we think the 11 that we surveyed is like a tip of the iceberg. I think there are many more. So our mapping and our study is at the moment, honestly speaking, very limited. We'll need to go back into the field when resources permit and also travel is a bit more flexible because we believe we can surface more of these. So that's another thing that we picked up. Was initially, as you said, Niamani, we were thinking of Community for Western Regions and also Community Foundation for the Western Region and Ubuntu. But we've been surprised by what we came across. Some of the foundations that we mapped did not respond to the questionnaires, which is still okay. So I think what we realized is at the beginning, we're not so sure if there's a field of work to be done. But after this study, we are now more certain that there's actually work that can be done in this space.
Thank you, Tendai. Etta, as the researcher on this, were there things that surprised you as you did this work?
Yeah, so for me, I think the one thing that was surprising, and more so when we actually did the publication, is so for these entities, it's something that they do. It's almost like a run-of-the-mill thing, but it's almost underestimating or just the value and importance of what they do and within the broader landscape across Zimbabwe. And for some of them, it was really the first time that someone had come and profiled their work and put together and was interested in like, okay, so what are you doing? We actually want to compile and share this information with across various platforms. So in the entities that we profiled, the 11, like only four have actually like a web presence or a website that's functioning. Others, you know, will, yes, there's some social media presence, you know, in terms of a WhatsApp and Facebook or in some instances, Twitter. But, you know, it's just to kind of post like, oh, we did this or we did this activity, you know, and it's like a lot of activity-based aspects. But I think for them, it was just the fact that we were keen and like want to walk in this journey with them to discover more about their work and get them thinking more about, okay, so what does it contribute within the broader development space and discussions in Zimbabwe besides just, you know, what's happening at the local community level? And I think as Tendai was saying that, like, you know, once we kind of changed up the language and shifted the language, that like what is out there and what is potentially out there for me is amazing. And the fact that it's not as widely acknowledged and recognized, I think for us as CVO, it also kind of just gives us the challenge that, like, you know what, we've got to bring what is happening and what communities are doing and the giving that goes on and the solidarity that's there to the fore, especially if we're going to be thinking about alternative ways of thinking about development and having communities actively involved in driving the development agenda in this country.
I think this is why the research that you guys have done and are doing is so important in terms of philanthropy targeting communities across Africa. Very often what I tell people is that just because you don't know about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I think very often in philanthropy, people feel that if they don't know about it, it's not happening. So I think this is really important and very useful for people to understand if they want to interface with civil society and organizations. How do you see private sector and government engaging with community philanthropy organizations? And have they enjoyed much success from these sectors?
So engagement by private sector and government with community philanthropy organizations, I think the potential is there for it to grow. I think for maybe private sector entities and government, it's also a situation of maybe not having the knowledge and information around who's doing what, when and how. So even with what we are doing and trying to map community foundations and community giving, it's a tool and a resource that we want to share across various potential funding partners that would want to come in to work with the communities, to partner with the communities, to enhance already the resources that are on the ground that the communities have mobilized. So, you know, whether it be from the private sector, from government, in terms of the next step for us after we kind of know who's doing what and we've mapped is the strengthening and, you know, enhancement of these entities and structures, is that we want it to be genuine partnerships. At the moment for private sector entities, even government, you know, so private sector will have like their community social responsibility, community social investment. And a lot of times it's still that very top-down heavy approach of dictating that like, okay, we've got this money and as the community, you must do A, B, C, D with it. The same thing with government as well, coming in and telling communities that, you know, this is your challenge, this is your problem, and this is how it can be resolved, and we'll give you the resources to do it, you know, but you must do it in this manner. So we want to see that there's genuine partnership, this genuine engagement and acknowledgement that the communities are starting from somewhere and the resources that they have extend beyond just, you know, looking at it in monetary terms. At the moment, whether they've enjoyed much support from these sectors, sectors. In the two studies that we've done so far, just focusing on community foundations and community-based organizations, for example, with COVID-19, you saw that there was government publicly announced a relief fund for private sector, for business, but nothing was said about the civil society organizations. No support has been publicly announced by them for entities working in this sector. And when we did our study, like only 6% of the organizations, you know, which is literally one or two, indicated that they had received some support from government. In terms of private sector, as Tendai mentioned, with the Community Share Ownership Trust, it was kind of mandated that these mining companies, mining entities provide resources for communities to decide how they would use them for the development within their local space. But like obviously with recent shifts in policy and the reversal of the indigenization or the modification of the Indigenization Act, I think it's still kind of something that we would want to try and see that can this support still continue? For us, it's to bring out or to highlight what's the value for private companies to be partnering up and to be involved, you know, in supporting the work that is done by community foundations or community-based organizations. But otherwise, more broadly speaking, you know, private sector as well, engagement has kind of been limited supporting these sectors. But as I said, we hope that through what we're doing and through raising the prominence of community philanthropy and community foundations, that it will get more government and private sector engagement to support the work that they're doing.
Tendai?
In a nutshell, we recognize that there's been an undoing, for instance, of a very strong partnership that government has sort of established between mining companies and communities. The reversal of the indigenization laws is in itself a reversal, because other groups actually coming out of Africa were coming to visit and to look at the Zimbabwe model around making sure that revenues for mining companies were being equitably shared with communities. So it's something that it's an advocacy position that needs to be taken, not only by CVO, but many other organizations that are sort of specialists in creating sort of advocacy messages on this. So that is number one. But the private sector, it's honestly, it's very uneven. During the peak of the COVID-19, you know, the threat around, COVID-19 is here and it's a huge threat to our livelihoods. Private sector entities were giving in such an amazing way towards reconstruction of hospitals, etc., and also working alongside feeding kitchens that had been established to help out in poor communities, etc. But with sort of the de-escalation of the threat to do with COVID-19, we begin to see also the movement away by the private sector. So I think there's a conversation that is not taking place in Zimbabwe around how we can sort of mobilize local resources beyond, you know, the token CSR sort of interventions, but to begin to say, how do we make these contributions sustainable, etc. So that's where we are. Literally, we're just at that stage to say, let's create a conversation, let's push this a bit forward, and also let's try to sort of harness the gains we made in the previous past.
So what do you see as the opportunities of community foundations to grow in their visibility and growth, especially with the prevailing economic crisis in Zimbabwe?
I think from the beginning, when we said we are unearthing a new sort of a new landscape, that it's not like we've discovered community philanthropy. It's always been there, but we were not looking at it properly and sort of writing about it, making sure that it's out there. That in itself, the magazine and many other products that will come out, we hope that it will trigger a conversation, not only like this kind of conversation, but even a conversation amongst the foundations themselves to begin, number one, to share best practice. Number two, hopefully we're trying to interest them in establishing their own association, an association of community foundations in Zimbabwe, which becomes maybe an infrastructure support organization towards helping with trainings, etc. So I think the disappointment that we have had with NGO-led or INGO-led development can sort of be resolved by local entities such as community foundations that leverage local voices and also local agendas in terms of enhancing community development. And also the state is weak in terms of responding to the crisis. It's evident. The state does not have a response to the vulnerability we see in communities. And we see these as entities as literally as first responders in moments of crisis. So they also need that sort of outside support so that they can also have that kind of weight that they need.
Etta, what do you see as the opportunities for community foundations to grow their visibility during this economic situation in Zimbabwe?
So, yeah, I share the same sentiments as Tendai that, you know, the opportunity is there given what's not happened with conventional development implementation and, you know, practice. But at the same time, the other thing is that with the transitional government, when this new government came in, they had a lot of focus on, you know, foreign direct investment, and that most of the money and resources will just pour in from outside of Zimbabwe. And that's going to be the basis for lifting, you know, or improving the socioeconomic conditions in the country. And it's now been almost three years down the line, and it's not really happened or taken off. And I think with what's happening also globally, what's happened with COVID, the way it's going to need like another 2-3 years for global economies to recover from what's happened, you know, is going to just see a shrinking in terms of, you know, development or development aid, you know, external development aid. And I think that's going to be the opportunity and a point from where, you know, community foundations, community philanthropy, domestic resource mobilization is going to become so much more key and important. And, you know, be highlighted further that communities are doing something. It must, prominence and role of it needs to be highlighted further, you know, and the necessary policy environment and structures must be in place to encourage and grow that kind of giving. So I think definitely the possibilities of it growing and being enhanced are there. And, you know, for us as CVO, it's like our role is going to be one of those entities that are supporting community foundations to raise their profile, you know, to raise the presence of the work that they're doing, you know, and begin to have wider visibility within the country, you know, and even across the region as well.
So what do you think are the biggest barriers or challenges to raising the importance of domestic resource mobilization and expanding the reach and profile of community organizations, other than the ones that you've talked about in your report? Are there other key barriers that you think are central and that prevent this from expanding? Tendai?
I think it's, thank you so much for that. And I'm glad that we're going out of the report. I think there's a big question that sort of the report makes reference to when you talk about community foundations that established by mining, sort of with mining companies. So these community foundations are not just about gathering resources, but they are also inserting communities in a different kind of discourse, a discourse around saying, do communities have a stake in the minerals that exist in their areas? This is a very important question, because even when we're saying that community foundations are being established in these mining areas, how equitable is the distribution of those resources vis-a-vis what mining companies are making? So this is a very big question to say, to the extent to say that, are we not seeing communities being bought off rather than seeing them as active participants in the accumulation from mining companies? So that's something that in the report we raised, that there are no proper sort of mechanisms of checking even the revenues made by mining companies. So they give of their own accord, they determine how much they are giving. So communities are not authentic or genuine partners in this. So the idea of partnership between mining companies and communities is something that has to be engendered. We need to make sure that there are certain mechanisms that community foundations that have this relationship with mining companies are also represented at board level within these mining companies so that they can have a voice. So that's important. Then number two, I think community foundations, like you have seen Niamani in the US, how communities have been at the center of the sort of the shift that the American political system has been requiring. I think for us also, we are saying that beyond just looking at these entities, just as entities that should focus on mobilizing resources to pay for school fees, to feed children, they are helping us to rethink democracy, rethink the role of communities in democracy. So when you begin to ask these big questions, then you begin to go into the issues to do with Do they have the right capacities? Do they have the right tools, the right skills to influence a different kind of conversation in communities beyond the welfare model that we see sort of dominant within community foundations? So the transition to empowered community foundations from where they are is the work that sort of we anticipate to do, because we see them playing, and the American elections and everything that we're hearing, the testimonies we're hearing, tell us that there's a very important part that communities, engaged communities, play in sort of the direction of your democratic path sort of text. So we're interested in sort of broadening how they see themselves beyond just seeing themselves as a conduit for money, but to begin to be at the center of the national development questions that are there. So yeah, the work is there, and it needs sort of a lot of sort of thinking around what kind of capacity support do you provide? What kind of orientation do we help them to have, et cetera, when they're questioning certain things, and so that they're just not living on the edge of the economy, but they become active participants in the economy and even in the democratic culture.
Etta, can I ask you to combine your response to that to any parting thoughts that you may have for us, since we're coming to the close of this session?
Sure. Thanks, Yamani. So for me, just in terms of the biggest barriers or challenges to raising the importance of domestic resource mobilization, I think it's the just shift in mindset and expansion of resources or assets that communities have. And what is considered a resource? I think a lot of time the focus has just been on monetary assets and monetary resources. And I think once that kind of shift is also made, then, you know, for communities, they begin to identify and, you know, see what it is that they have inherently and within themselves, you know, that will allow them to then expand and enhance what it is that they're doing and realize the value and importance of it. So enhancing just how communities view themselves, as Tendai mentioned, you know, and how they see themselves, not just as just recipients of resources or recipients of development, but as being co-creators and co-producers of how they want to see their communities, their economies, that they are at the center of it and they have the means and the resources to do so. And I think it cuts across just in terms of what it is that our focus at Sevier is, you know, just to have the citizen back at the center of policymaking, of development of the economy, you know, and getting involved and being involved and having an, you know, a fair chance to be included in processes. And, you know, the way the situation is in Zimbabwe at the moment is, you know, there's a lot of everything is kind of top down. There's a lot of technocratic approach, you know, in terms of how this crisis is going to be resolved that leaves the citizen out of it. And for us, you know, we want to be building, you know, an inclusive society where citizens are at the core of developing policy of and what we're doing in this space around philanthropy, around giving. It excites us a lot because we want to showcase, you know, and enhance the existing solidarity that's already there in communities. There's been several studies that have shown and demonstrated that in rural and urban areas, the grassroots people have a penchant for establishing local community groups, which contribute to the mobilization of productive assets. And why, you know, for us, community foundations are so important is that we subscribe to the thinking that community foundations, if adequately resourced and supported through technical support, adequate governance mechanisms, funding support, they're going to be a key and a central driver to inclusive development in this country, helping to develop this movement, this coalition, this network, you know, of community foundations in Zimbabwe that will get the thought process around development and how it's been done to be reconsidered and shifted so that communities, citizens remain central to it and are really included in the process of advancing the development that they want to see in this country.
Thank you, Etta. And as the saying goes, Tendai, you have the last word. Any parting thoughts that you'd like to leave with us about either the research in particular or the work that Sevier is doing in general?
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Niamani, number one, for having us here. And number two, the conversation that we've had, it's been very enriching. And also it leaves a lot of sort of things that we need to think about. But I think one of the things that we don't want to sound like we're doing, we are not romanticizing community philanthropy amongst the poor. We appreciate the role of external support, but we think those partnerships are better when communities are engaged instead of disengaged communities. So that's number one. We're very sort of particular about that. We don't want to sound like, oh, they don't need aid or they don't need support. We're just saying that the different kind of partnerships that we need, and those partnerships should be where you're finding communities already engaged in something. And we also appreciate the fact that communities already have sort of an understanding of what they need and where they need to go. And whatever external aid that comes should come to work alongside in complementarity with what communities are doing. So this applies to governments, private philanthropy, and NGOs. Another stream of work that we do in the Center of Philanthropy is to analyze high net worth giving in Zimbabwe and across Africa. And so for us is to begin to say, how do we create relationships, synergies between these two? Because at the moment, when you look at the work that is happening, you see silos. It's a silo-based approach. Rarely is there conversation. High net worth philanthropy is a bit problematic in the sense that they come in knowing everything. They come in, they have all the money, they know everything. So it's to begin to say, how do we make sure that these high net worth philanthropists can actually be part of conversations to do with community development and establish new partnerships? So I think the work has just begun for us in Zimbabwe. Philanthropy, by its very nature as a programming area in Zimbabwe, is a purple cow. It's something that we want to develop, make sure that there are more voices beyond CVO Institute that are talking about these issues. So we create a community of practice amongst peers, because once we have that, then we can begin to influence development or development patterns, development regimes, especially coming from government and NGOs. So in a nutshell, again, thanks for having us, Nyaman. It came as a pleasant surprise when you made the invitation, and we're excited that we could sort of spend an hour with you talking about this.
Well, thank you, Tendai, and thank you, Etta, for taking the time to talk with us. In addition to the two reports that we discussed today, the CVO Institute has other research on different sectors in Zimbabwe, from government performance to citizen participation to think tanks. And I think for those who are interested in funding in Zimbabwe, this type of information is invaluable in deepening their understanding of the environment in which civil society organizations are operating. For those of us who are based at a distance, and particularly during this time period of COVID-19, when travel has been restricted, I think it's even more important than ever to understand what's happening and to build those relationships so that people who are interested in funding have an understanding of the organizations that are on the ground. So again, our thanks to both of you. Take care. Be safe.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Conversations With. We hope you enjoyed it. Please visit our website at africagrantmakers.org and join our mailing list. Until our next Conversations With, be well.